Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of the Typo Positive podcast. Yes, the episode that has been longer coming than the royal wedding. And I know what you're asking, where is episode 5? Well, I did record parts of episode 5 last year, back in 2017. However, the hard drive that they're on seems to have disappeared. I'm not sure where those recordings have gone. Eventually I'll find those recordings and slap it all back together. However, last year I haven't had much of a chance to do any recording, or in the last year and a half, because I've been working two jobs and there was that whole wedding thing to plan for. So much for those recordings. Anyway, on with the show. Well, today I'm going to be talking about visiting a museum or gallery in Rome. I'll leave that as a bit of a surprise as to why I'm doing that. And I'm also going to be talking about 3D printing typewriters. As the technology progresses with 3D printing, it's coming to the point where people are saying, can we produce a 3D printed typewriter? Well, if you recall back, I think in 2013, I did a bit of a discussion blog on how to 3D print a typewriter, and I'm going to do a bit of an update and catch up on that in this podcast. So we'll talk about that in the Filthy Labs segment. Anyway, on with the show. Design and history are your thing, then there's few cities in the world quite like Rome to visit. Miss Jane and I had a bit of a chance to go there in March this year, and I can't say I was disappointed. We visited some incredible galleries. Of note, the Vatican Museum, whereas everybody is aware that the Vatican is, of course, the centre of Catholicism for the world. They maintain multiple museums with some very amazing sculptures and artworks that date back thousands of years, being the organisation the Catholics are. They have been very adept at creating some incredible collections. There, for example, as far back as ancient Egypt, and naturally there's a fair bit of ancient Rome there as well. Anyway, that's not the galleries I want to speak about today. What I want to speak about is the gallery of, and let's see if I can get this right, it is the Galleria Nazionale d'Arte Moderna. I am very sorry to any Italian out there who is now frantically typing at the keyboard wanting to tell me what I've done wrong. As you'd imagine, the National Gallery of Art in Rome has some incredible pieces on display. The displays themselves are very diverse. They cover everything from local Italian artists with contemporary collections to your classic names like Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol. There's several pieces by those artists there. But there's also some very strong classical pieces that are on display there. Rome being Rome always seems to have one foot in the past and one foot in the contemporary. This ethos seemed to set the foundation for an exhibition that happened to be running while I was in Rome called Looking Forward, Olivetti, 110 Years of Imagination. Oddly enough, it's all about Olivetti, the company, and at the very core of that, the typewriter company that was once Olivetti. When you walk into the exhibition, you're greeted by a Olivetti MP1 on the ground and a brief history of the foundations of the forming of the Olivetti company and what came before the company itself. Then you walk into a large gallery room where there are multiple screens on the walls. These screens are displaying Olivetti ads of yesteryear. They've also got some video and film taken from some of the very lavish launch parties of the previous Olivetti products. And, of course, there is plenty of typewriters on display in this room. The very tall white walls, of course, offset the knee-high tables where several typewriters were on display, along with the design history and how those typewriters came about and what their prominence and relevance is and was to art and design of that era. Some of the video work that Olivetti produced over the years was just outright bizarre. Things from dancing fingers on a keyboard to dancing chairs to very abstract 60s pieces of artwork that today seem very dated, but of course are really a part of what made up the modern design languages that we still follow to this day. In the main gallery room, there's a couple of items of interest to typewriter collectors. There's the Lettera 22. It's in a mushroom design in colour and doesn't seem particularly inspirational, but when you see it in the context of a modern gallery like this, it seems to feel like a very important piece. And when you think about it, it really is an important piece. It showed Olivetti's direction change from the earlier MP1 era. That was that classic cast iron, we're producing typewriters just like everybody else, to the modern, sleek, elegant, but placed alongside some of the other contemporary pieces of design from Olivetti. The Diesperon, or whatever you want to call it, seems to have a design language of its own. It fits quite nicely with some of the calculator and other desktop product designs that Olivetti had on the market at the time. Moving out of that room into some of the smaller sub-rooms, of course, you come across the most iconic piece of design from Olivetti, which is the Olivetti Valentine. We all know what it looks like. And there was only a red Valentine on display. I would have expected something more inspirational, like, say, for example, the rarer blue or white or green Valentines, but the in essence, the red Valentine is probably the most iconic of the Valentines that are out there. Anyway, there's a discussion as to how the Valentine's design came about. We do like to often throw around Edouard Sotsis's name in relation to the Valentine. Sotsis wasn't entirely the principal person in the design of the Valentine. It seems to be far too easy to forget that Perry King was also involved in the design of the Olivetti. Now, Sotsis's design influence on Olivetti is quite prominent through the display. His name does pop up on several machines. However, Perry's name also is just as important across several designs. Interestingly, Sotsis's name is probably the most prominent when it comes to the furniture offerings of Olivetti. Olivetti produced several desks and office chairs as well to match their products. Of course, a lot of those things over the years have disappeared into trash piles, having probably been less enduring than most typewriters, because first and foremostly, they were items, when you think about it, desk is not something that becomes obsolete, at least in contemporary structure of things, as well as a chair. You're always going to be using a chair. You're always going to be using a desk. Whereas a typewriter itself, well, progressively has become less and less useful from an office efficiency point of view. So as they continue to be used, well, they generally just experience more wear and tear and were eventually just thrown out, whereas the typewriters tended to be preserved because they outlived their usefulness. Most of these pieces feature the prominent curved edges that you see in the design language of today. And when you see these designs, you find yourself thinking That's very much what you see in the design language of, say, Apple these days. There's those very structured curved edges, very clean curved edges, and almost slab-like planes across surfaces that aren't adorned and textured. The base itself is a cross shape in a very vibrant yellow colour, and featured those very minimalist 90-degree perpendicular edges to each other with curves running through between them. The seat itself was a something of a brown canvas tweed, which matched the design quite nicely, but of course the brown dated it almost instantly. So it does look very much, with the exception of the yellow plastics of the base, the chair itself looks incredibly 1960s, 1970s, early 70s. So it doesn't really look like it would sit well in a contemporary office. But it was and is a very interesting piece of design. And you can see those curves mimicking the angular 90-degree curves of the Valentine. In the case of the Valentine, the 90-degreeness of it is almost entirely there, so it offsets the angular face, which looks quite different to the rest of the machine. It gives it that edgy look, otherwise it would just look like a simple box. The same design tricks were used in the Olivetti DL, that's the leather, or well, the faux leather, an aluminium plastic piece, often I think referred to as the DL33 or the Deluxe. That was also a Sotsis and Perry King design. Unfortunately, that machine does not feature in this display, which is I was quite sad about, because I think when it comes down to it, with the exception of the fact that it's much more subtle, that Lettre Deluxe, in design-wise, compared to the, say, the Olivetti Valentine, I personally think that the Deluxe is quite possibly Olivetti's nicest design produced. However, when you're looking at a lot of these displays from Olivetti, there's one thing that you come to realize about the modern design language, particularly when you're looking at the contemporaries of that language, say, let's look at Apple specifically, in that Olivetti had at least some courage to use bold colors and things. And whereas you look at Apple and everything is that, as much as it is minimalist and out of the way and very nicely designed, there isn't that boldness of colour anymore. What changed Apple as a design company was their willingness to move into different designs back in the late 90s when the world was full of beige computers. Nowadays, the sheer lack of colour and boldness in that colour, with the exception of what's on display on the screen, is something that's been pulled out of Apple's design aesthetic. Anyway, moving on, back to the Olivetti display. Olivetti, of course, pushed this design language through into other displays, such as other products, for example, desk caddies and calculators. And Olivetti's calculators and adding machines are also on display at the exhibition. Now, if you head upstairs from the ground floor exhibitions, you come across an Olivetti Praxis and an Olivetti adding machine that used the very similar, the very design language that was used across the Praxis with its its virtually floating keyboard. The keyboard, if you've ever seen a Praxis, it sets itself different to the machine in that the keyboard seems to be positioned up above the table as if it's floating away from the table, whereas it's counterweighted by, of course, that massive electrical mechanical body that is at the back of the Praxis. And Olivetti had, of course, the matching adding machine for that praxis, and equally as over-engineered and complicated as the praxis itself. Olivetti did this with almost every one of their typewriters, whereas you could go into the store and you could buy a Lettra 32, or say, for example, one of their desktop machines, a Studio 42 or a Studio 44, and you could go and buy an adding machine that would look exactly like the Studio 44 that you could put on the desk next to you, and you can match that with your office decor. And of course, Olivetti produced much of that decor as well. Desk caddies for your pens and your pieces of paper also came in the same colour scheme and the same design language. So Olivetti was very much about keeping that design language across that generation of products. Of course, over the years, a lot of those things have been separated, so you don't see that quite as much. You don't see a lot of those Olivetti products side by side anymore. but Olivetti, as a design company, went far beyond just those simple consumer products that are in the office space. Olivetti put a lot of that design mentality and culture into producing posters and advertising. And even further than that, they put it into producing homes and living spaces. So Olivetti, as they grew as a company and produced larger and larger factories in different regions across the world, Olivetti started to put a lot of those design principles into the factories and homes that they were designing. And unfortunately, the exhibition is, I think, closing soon. If you walk around to the upstairs section, you can find some photographs taken from the Olivetti factories of the workers. There's a lot of those photos of happy workers greeting the cameraman. But there's a lot of photographs of Olivetti factories, buildings, offices in the process of construction, and highlighting a lot of the design functions that went into producing a lot of those buildings. And a lot of those buildings still stand to this day. Olivetti produced plants in not just Italy, they also produced them in Portugal and Brazil. So those are also featured there. And when you're entering into the Olivetti display, they have several posters that depict Olivetti's plants, factories, etc., and offices across several of the regions in Italy and the world, including Spain. And you can, if you look hard enough, you can find all of those places depicted in the photographs that are up in the on display in the exhibition. And that's the thing about us as typewriter collectors. We often see Olivetti as a piece of history, a company of the past. And even though we're using these pieces of equipment that are really part of that history, part of history, they're not something that is a modern piece of commonplace equipment anymore. Typewriters are not found in offices and people's homes as anywhere near as frequently as they were in the past. So we often see Olivetti as part of that. It's gone, those days are over. And in a lot of ways, this exhibition challenges those ideas. It's all about saying, no, Olivetti is a piece of Italy today. Italy's economy is going through this major transitional stage. They're moving on to moving out of the economy of what they were previously and trying to rebuild and reinvent themselves again. And Italy's been through this before. Italy in the 1970s had to go through a retransformation of their economy. And as the economy in Europe is shifting, as the deficits of other countries around them influence the kind of economies and manufacturing that can occur in that region, Italy is finding itself being reinvented. And Olivetti themselves are being reinvented at the moment. They are producing different, new and different technologies, mostly industrial technologies. However, they do also have consumer products. That said, those consumer products are like with a lot of the American companies, those consumer products are now produced by Chinese. They've got Olivetti brandings stickered onto them, but they're still a Chinese product, a very generic item. However, the larger industrial products that the Chinese themselves aren't very good at, that's where Olivetti's going. And in the main hall next to the major Olivetti exhibition, Olivetti have this piece of equipment that has links to weather data, all that sort of stuff, and shows how it connects up with office hardware. Unfortunately, the Olivetti of today doesn't seem to have the same sort of design ethos that Olivetti in the past did. The new Olivetti technology seems to be very much rooted in the 90s rather than being a contemporary leader in changing the direction and the language of design. That seems to be up to other companies these days. And in that room, positioned next to that, the coming and contemporary technologies by Olivetti, you've got a display of the of Olivetti's probably most successful design changes, which is the Lettre 22. And the Lettre 22 is stacked and depicted vertically up a wall, like paintings, in every colour and incarnation that Olivetti produced the Lettre 22 in the years that it produced it. So it is a bit of a knowledge to what was great about Olivetti's past and saying we are optimistically looking at the future. Unfortunately, the rest of the room is very empty. You can interpret this to mean either, well, you know, we've got scope to grow, or maybe that the curators themselves are saying, well, you've got nothing else. As it happens, there's an exit right there. So if you wish to leave, maybe they're hinting in a way to Olivetti, there's the door, see you later, you're of the past. But, you know, in a lot of ways, the whole exhibition is very optimistic. You've got the smiling faces of the workers in the photographs. And as I look back nostalgically of the beauty of what Olivetti had produced in the past, in saying that we are still capable of doing this in the future. And that's really what this exhibition is about. It's a look at the past, the 110 years of Olivetti's history, while saying we are moving forward. And that's what it comes down to when you exit the display. You say to yourself, well, what exactly are you, where are you going? Where is Olivetti as a company going? It isn't just a piece of history, but there is some incredible history there. Now, once you leave the gallery and head out into the real world, you find that Olivetti has a very strong presence in Italy still. There's Olivetti stores, maybe not the iconic Olivetti stores of the past, but you can still find Olivetti around the place. They produce printers, calculators, and other pieces of office equipment, which is still very popular in Italy. So you've got a lot of those little side street stores, computer stores that have this Olivetti equipment. So it's at least to the Italians, the Olivetti name is still relevant. And that's true for a lot of the other iconic typewriter histories of the companies in the past. Smith Corona still exists. Royal still exists. Olympia still exists. In fact, you can still get the Chinese-made Royals, whereas Olympia, they still produce electronic typewriters. So these companies are still out there. And in a lot of ways, the typewriter is not a piece of history. It has informed the language of what we do today. I mean, we have still not moved away from the keyboards that we use. We still use keyboards that are rooted very much in that typewriter history past. And a lot of what we look at around us, and as you get a sense of this from the exhibition, it's been pioneered by design companies such as Olivetti. And if you're ever wanting to get a sense of what, say, the Olivetti shops or retail outlets were like, you can actually do that by going to Venice and going and having a look at the iconic Olivetti typewriter store in Venice. But I'll probably discuss more of that in my blog sometime in the future. Anyway, I hope you found this little retrospective look at the exhibition at the Gallery of Modern Art in Rome interesting. You'll probably miss it, but for me, it has really cemented that view that the typewriter is not so much just a consumable product, it's just a machine that was once it is and was, but in a lot of ways, and Olivetti really is the core of this, the typewriter was a piece of industrial art, and the National Gallery of Modern Art in Italy clearly recognised that the typewriter is that piece of modern art or modern design that I often have seen it to be myself. Anyway, thank you for listening. Let's move on to the Filthy Labs segment. Well, it's time for another episode of Filthy Labs, and as you may be able to hear, there's a bit of machinery operating in the background here. This is a 3D printer. I'm just going to let this print away while having a bit of a chat about what's going on. So at the moment, I've got a metallic coloured filament loaded into the 3D printer, and I am producing a component apart from the standard folding typewriter, the pre-Corona 3 typewriter. I won't say what part it is. It's only a draft copy at the moment for a trial prototype, but that's what's currently on the print bed. Now, I talked about 3D printing typewriters way back in 2012, and back then the question was posed, can we 3D print a typewriter? And back then, the answer was, well, yes, but things have come a long way since 2012. I mean, that's, what, 6 years ago now. So I thought I'd revisit the subject again with the changes that there have been in technology. And there have been, well, there's been changes in the technology in relation to what is available to the domestic and home consumer. There are now sub-$500, in fact the sub-$200 3D printers. You can go out and buy yourself a printer or buy it online, have it sent to your home, and either use it out of the box, or the cheapest ones require a fair bit of assembly. Construct yourself a 3D printer and then start producing your own parts. Now, there's nothing simple about 3D printing. It, when it comes down to it, the printers themselves are still industrial pieces of equipment, and they operate like industrial pieces of equipment. It's not like your little printer at home where you can just punch out a photo and get an amazing result. You still need to be able to understand a fair amount involved with the plastics and the hardware involved in the 3D printer to be able to operate one. So it's not the sort of thing that, you know, every person's going to be able to just pop into a corner of their home and hit a button to produce the part that they need, at least at this stage. And it may not really ever get there because it's something that's not really where the market is going to head for quite some time. But that said, with the decreased prices in domestic 3D printers, there's a lot of other technologies as well that can also contribute to producing typewriter parts that are now cheaper and easier to get hold of. When it comes down to it, 3D printing is a bit of a broad name for a group of technologies. When most people think about a 3D printer, they think about something called an FDM printer, and that's a printer that uses a plastic filament and deposits those plastic as dots and lines at a time in layers, and builds up an item by producing those layers one on top of each other, just laying down bits of plastic. However, there are other technologies that come under this 3D printing umbrella. Things like laser cutters. That's becoming a
a big thing in the market these days. Laser cutters are more of a two-dimensional thing, but laser cutting also allows you to produce two-dimensional shapes that could be bent or pushed into place on other parts and produce a three-dimensional object. There's also resin printers, and resin printers are starting to come down in price as well. These are things that use a little bath of molten plastic or resin and shoots a pattern via UV light into that resin from underneath and allows them to step by step produce an object by pulling that printed part out of that resin. Now, getting more in the more expensive side of things, these are the things that are not quite accessible for the general public at this stage, mainly because of the price point. There's technologies like selective sintering, and that's sort of like a laser that burns away bits of metal around the shape. And there's also CNC control equipment. Now, CNC equipment is rapidly coming down in price, but is mostly out of reach of the most domestic buyers. You're still looking around the $5,000 mark for something that, you know, produces a result that may not be quite what you want. So that's how the technology has changed. Now, the reason why a lot of these printers have come down in price and the is because progressively patents relating to various 3D technologies have run out, which is meant that your backyard producer or your producer in China is able to take an existing something that was previously patented and protected under patent and now just run it off at a large mass production rate. And that's the key part, is that it is now easy for those producers to mass produce these things without having to pay somebody else for, say, a license, which often adds to the cost, even if they can even negotiate that license. Also, because of this, it means that a market has opened up that has access to much cheaper parts. Now, cheaper parts aren't necessarily a good thing. This printer behind me is a cheap printer, and those cheap parts will burn out probably a lot faster than your regular, more expensive, high-tech printers will. At the same time, when you think about it, say, for example, a stepper motor, that's $7 to buy from China. Once that burns out, I can just throw that out and put another $7 stepper motor in. So the efficiencies are there, but it just means there's a lot more downtime related to that piece of equipment operating. And of course, as I touched on, the mass production of key components with those patents out of the way, economies of scale have a major contributor. You now can produce the components needed at a far cheaper rate because you're producing a lot of them at once. So we come back to that question of, can a typewriter be 3D printed? And the answer still is a very broad yes, but. But that yes, but is very different to what it was in 2012. The yes, but is more related to the fact we have a difference in techniques that we can use to produce these machines. So the technology to make the parts is now rapidly coming down in price to get key small components on the market. Say, for example, back in 2012, companies like AliExpress didn't exist. So if you want those tiny, tiny little springs that you need, it was always hard to get that negotiated through your local hardware store. Whereas now you can just pop online and just hunt down the particular spring that you need and order them at 2,000 at a time. That was not so easy to access previously. But when it comes down to it, it's more the software side of things that are a hindrance now. I'm going to say something, and this may seem a little bit rude to some people, but 3D printing a typewriter is inevitable. A lot of people probably would feel a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that there's going to be a 3D printed typewriter out there. It's almost absurd to think that the pinnacle of technology as we sit at this time in history is producing something that's 100 years old. In a lot of ways, people using their typewriters, they're trying to escape back away from that technology. And here we are just rushing headfirst into being able to say, hey, can we use this technology to produce something that's, well, largely considered non-technology. The reason why I say this is a little bit rude is, well, this is going to come as a bit of a shock to you, but typewriters are the machines that pushed that technology. The capacity to be able to operate, to have a keyboard sitting in your home to be able to operate what you need, gave birth to the computer generation, the potential to be able to input something into a machine to be able to produce what you want. That's what typewriters are. That said, we all do. You're listening to this podcast because you like mechanical typewriters. And as it stands, there's probably a lot of interest in, can we 3D print a typewriter? Can I have a Scholz and Glidden sitting on my desk, 3D printed? Can I just hit a button and have this thing pop out in the machine? Well, yes, it is possible, and it is not just possible, it's also probable. And the reason why it's probable is because it's likely to be preserving history. But there's challenges involved in that. And the reason that being is that 3D printing isn't about just producing a single item at once. If you're going to 3D print a typewriter, you're going to be 3D printing each individual component. The reason why it's inevitable that you're going to be able to 3D print an entire typewriter is as progressively as a lot of these older machines of ours break down, those components are going to be begun to be produced on 3D printers. And already that's happening. The community out there is already producing replacement platen knobs. God knows that everybody's out there screaming for the Hermes 3000 platen knobs. 3D printing platen knobs, 3D printing keys, 3D printing spools, 3D printing spool covers, 3D printing replacement sections of, cases, cover plates. That's what I was looking for. Sorry, John. I know you're sitting there going, Scott, you're saying cover plates. Anyway, so, yes, the cover plates are the things that are going to be repaired and replaced via these 3D printing technologies. And progressively over time, we're going to start seeing things like typefaces and type bars also produced as well. Type bars have been probably the biggest challenge when it comes to 3D printing. This is what I said way back in 2012. The humble type bar might just look like a pressed piece of metal, but it's actually a very complicated piece of metal in that the metal is actually treated in three different sections through the length of the type bar. So the metal has different characteristics for what happens at the typeface or where it hits the page, what happens along the length, or it needs to flex, all that sort of stuff. So it's a spring steel and a hardened steel and a annealed steel for towards the base of the type bar. So this is not something that's going to be just easily achieved overnight, but it's something that can be achieved, and it can be achieved now. If we want to start printing typefaces and start printing type bars, that technology exists right now. It's quite accessible to be able to get hold of or rent at least a selective sintering machine, which allows us to basically cut through sheet metal and produce the type bars that we need, that we then just need to use techniques to bend them into the shapes that we need. Now, one of the things that's going to slow this down is the complexities in drafting the components. When it comes down to it, the people who are most interested in producing these parts for typewriters may not necessarily have the knowledge or the skills to be able to easily draft and design these typewriter parts in computer-aided design software, which is what our 3D printer needs. That's changing. There are people out there who do have those skills. I have computer aided design skills, and I am slowly working through designing parts myself progressively and sharing those occasionally with people that I know when people are ask for them. So over time, people are going to get, we're going to build a catalogue of components, typewriter components out there to access, to be able to just to produce those 3D prints. But from that point onwards, the other element comes in play of lack of knowledge. So when you've got that part, assembling and adjusting a typewriter, because you are going to have to assemble a typewriter. As I said, you can't just pull it off the bed, print it and ready to go. You'll have to assemble all these parts you produce. And the knowledge to be able to assemble that and adjust those, well, that generation of manufacturers and repair people, well, they're dying off. And a lot of that knowledge is kind of going by the wayside. There's a bit of it in the AIMS manuals and workshop manuals out there, but the general technique and the technology is not quite there anymore. This doesn't mean that all is lost. That knowledge is certainly out there in other disciplines. But as far as the as typewriter collecting and typewriter manufacturing is concerned, it's not quite as accessible as it used to be. That will change. And when it changes, something very unexpected and probably unusual is going to happen. For the first time, we're actually going to see, first time, say, maybe 30 or 40 years, we're going to see an entirely new typewriter. The reason this is going to happen is because now the 3D printing technology allows us to rapidly prototype parts, and computer-aided design also allows us to rapidly change and redesign parts. Over the years, a lot of the old designs that are out there were designed for manufacturing processes and materials technologies that we've actually moved quite a long way past. So, as this happens, we're going to start seeing a lot of the design faults that were in the machines, and we're going to see people correcting those design faults and changing the way that we produce and design those typewriter parts so they match the way the materials and the way that things are manufactured today. This is going to result in very different machines to what we have used in the past. There's still going to be manual machines, and imagine that's the direction people are going to want to go. That's why they'll be doing it, for the challenge of that. But it will be a new and very different typewriter. When it comes down to the structure and the shape of the typewriter as well, the limitations of hand-drafted designs that we've had over the years can easily be overcome by the computer-aided design. That said, computer-aided design also allows people to produce very lazy designs. So, for example, when you look at the typewriters of the late 1970s and 1980s, when computer-aided design started to come into play, allowing people to be able to produce cover plates. So no one bothered redesigning the mechanical side of typewriters anymore. That was an established structure. Things like the Olympia Carina, the Nakajima produced Olympias, they use computer-aided designed cover plates that have very angular and very the fillets along the edges are very easy to produce. Hence, the design of those machines is incredibly boring. That's also not helped by the fact they almost always made them a beige in colour. So the flat slabs of the computer-aided era, that's potentially going to happen in the way we redesign parts in the very near future when it comes to producing new typewriter components. Anyway, that's a bit of a look at the direction as to where we're going now. But as I said, it's inevitable that we're going to have a 3D printed typewriter. I think it's going to be very different to what we currently have. But when it comes down to it, it's going to be Making parts, replacement parts for the typewriter, for typewriters, our existing typewriters, is really what is going to be happening of 3D printing technology in the near future, and probably the distant future as well. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I hope you've had a good time. See you soon. And keep typing. And that wraps up another episode of the Typo Positive Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you got a bit of insight into 3D printing and what it can offer typewriter manufacturing and repair in the future, and a bit of an insight into the National Gallery of Modern Art in Italy's Olivetti display. Unfortunately, being a podcast, I'm never going to be able to capture quite the beauty of the exhibition, but I hope I gave you a bit of a look as to what was going on. Thank you very much, and I hope to hear you typing soon.